Our last case this morning is A23-1906, Sugarman et al. Versus Muddy Waters Capital et al. Thank you. As you're getting settled, again, as I indicated, this case is A23-1906, Sugarman et al. Versus Muddy Waters Capital et al. As all parties are aware, the appellants will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then finally the appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever counsel is ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level up and down, and the podium goes up and down, and just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Is this an appropriate height? Can you hear me?
It's up to you. I think we can hear you, but I mean, if the podium goes up and down, if you want to get a little closer to you, it's up. I mean, it's whatever you're comfortable with, sir.
Thank you for your courtesy, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jeremy Deutsch with the law firm of Cozen O'Connor. I'm here on behalf of the appellants in this matter. We are back before this court for a second time. The court on remand in the first instance when it overturned the trial court for its grant of a form nonconvenience motion gave the trial court both a roadmap and the rules of the road in how to consider a form nonconvenience motion. The trial court abused its discretion by deviating from the map and violating the rules of the road. The trial court did not consider whether California was an adequate forum. The explanation in the relevant precedent is that if a statute of limitations may act to bar plaintiff's claims, it makes it an inadequate forum. The trial court failed to consider that question. The trial court relied instead on a proposed stipulation, but the error in relying on a proposed stipulation is first that the stipulation itself was flawed, and secondly, the trial court's analysis should have stopped with the determination, as we believe, that California was not an adequate forum. An inadequate forum, as the Bank of Pakistan case says, is a forum in which a statute of limitations may act to bar a claim. Under those circumstances, this forum was not a hospitable forum. I think it is clear that the respondent's papers make clear that the difference in statute of limitations, they believe, will bar plaintiff's claims in the state of California. It is thrown into sharp relief when you look at the difference between the Erickson case in Minnesota, which recognizes an ongoing enterprise or a continuing violation, and the case that I can't pronounce, Maris Scandari case that they cite to, which says that California will reject that concept. California statute of limitations is shorter. The trial court failed to come to grips with these differences, and in doing so, violated its obligation and abused its discretion.
Why isn't the way the district court handled this consistent with our decision in Kennicott from 1997?
Well, I don't believe it's consistent with either Kennicott or Burquist, Your Honor. I think that both of them require you to actually determine that it's an adequate forum, and I think that the trial court here went, in essence, it cut to the end without doing the work in between and just said, well, the stipulation says that it is an adequate forum, and the court continued to confuse the difference between available forum and adequate forum. And by looking to say, well, California is essentially a bastion of consumer protection law and therefore is a hospitable forum. But the very narrow question that needed to be answered was, would California entertain these claims? And we believe the answer, I take the respondents at their word, and they say that it would not entertain these claims. So I don't think it's consistent.
Well, I think they're saying that neither Minnesota nor California would entertain these claims because they both are barred by the statute of limitations. And isn't that different than just whether California would? I guess tell me if that's a distinction without a difference. That's
so. I don't believe that it ultimately matters. I think that the respondents are wrong on both. I do not concede that it is necessarily barred in California. What I'm saying is that they argue that it is barred and that the Coloplast case says it's clear that if it may be barred, as does the Central Bank of Pakistan case, if it may be barred, if it may not be hospitable, then that is sufficient for a court to deny, to determine that it is not an adequate forum. And I believe that that was the mistake that the trial court entered into here by not actually coming to grips and doing the analysis as to whether it was an adequate forum. It was an error that was perpetuated from the first opinion where the first trial court failed to conduct an analysis as to whether it was an adequate forum. Every time I say it, it sounds like inadequate. Sorry. In any event.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just going to pick my argument back up. If you had a question, I'm here for your questions.
You know, the other thing we asked them to do is discuss the presumption that people are entitled to their forum. Do you believe the court did that?
I do not.
Why not?
For several reasons. This may be a somewhat long answer, so feel free to interrupt me if you feel I'm going far.
No, we don't need to show how smart we are.
Fair enough. I think the court failed to do that because the instruction on the remand order was clear, and this is one of the rules of the road I referred to. The court was instructed below to apply the strong presumption. The strong presumption has to heavily outweigh the private and public interest factors.
Right, and, you know, as I recall so many months ago, I did have concerns about whether this was forum shopping, as did the panel. And, you know, the court, I think, discussed that and said that, you know, even that presumption that you're entitled to the forum you're in can be overcome by forum shopping. And now with the moving of the individual from out of state to Tennessee, you know, that seems to reinforce that issue. So, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, at least on that factor, that seems enough for me. Now, why am I wrong, Mr. Deutsch?
You're wrong because there is no proof, no evidence, no competent demonstration that my clients engaged in forum shopping. The Irigori case makes it clear that...
Well, how many cases are in California and how many cases are here?
Well, sir, I don't know how many cases are currently pending in California because none of those cases in California that are currently pending involve this plaintiff and these defendants. We're not in... These parties are not in litigation in California. These parties were in litigation in the federal district courts in California. That court, sua sponte, determined it did not have jurisdiction over this action when it dismissed the federal question. And in that process, plaintiffs refiled in the first and only state court that they could determine had personal jurisdiction over every defendant. That has been conceded. Personal jurisdiction is available here. Trial courts have noted that. Secondly, this was the center of the conspiracy, as per our allegations, which are at this stage of the complaint have to be accepted as true. The publications took place either from here or in the state of Minnesota, and the conspiracy we allege was centered here. This wasn't chosen because there was an adverse ruling in a California state court. This wasn't chosen. The cases that have been cited for forum shopping in support of this, putting to one side the Reed case, which is the one case the trial court cited to, That case is not applicable. I might as well address it now. That case dismissed on a...
But it is fair to say none of the defendants are now in Minnesota. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Deutsch?
I don't actually know that that is true because the defendants haven't put in a single declaration of their clients. So I don't know if they didn't leave employees here. It's impossible to say. I believe that there has been a change.
Does it matter when we're doing a forum non-convenience analysis whether in the midst of litigation some of the parties move?
I don't believe that it matters at this stage for two reasons. One, no case law has been cited to suggest that the time at which you look at this is a shifting time frame on a continuum. We believe that you look at this at the time of the filing of the complaint. At the time of the filing of the complaint, the defendants who were at the heart of this were Minnesota residents.
Do you have any case law? Because it does seem like if it's a moving target, right, that would give some incentives for companies to move their headquarters if you had a big lawsuit filed in a certain state to try to avoid that law. So just it does seem like, it seems like you look at it at the time of the complaint, but I don't have any case law to support that. Do you have any cases that is in fact the case?
If I do, I do not recall them at the moment. They would be in my papers. But I would like to just remind the court, that isn't my burden. If the defendants want to move...
Well, you've alleged that they live in Minnesota, right? So for the purpose of the complaint, they live in Minnesota?
Which they did at the time that we brought the action. And if they would like to come before you and say that it is appropriate to consider new developments... They did that on the basis of a D.C. case, a District of Columbia case, that said in the context of a child support case, essentially, yes, we're going to consider a change in circumstances where someone moved. And that makes perfect sense because a court that is more geographically equipped to oversee whether a child is being looked after, that makes sense to me. But here, this is a defamation case and a conspiracy case. That they moved is not appropriate at this stage. It might have been appropriate if they had allowed discovery to take place, and then they said, "Now look, we've demonstrated there are no witnesses in Minnesota. There's no proof in Minnesota. There's no records in Minnesota. There's nothing in Minnesota any further. But there is no proof of that before you." Somebody has to hold the defendants to their burden on these motions, and no court has actually done that. None of the trial courts have.
Just so that I'm clear on your argument, are you arguing that the district court erred in sort of making a finding that there are no parties in Minnesota and that the district court abused its discretion in then relying on that finding to determine that... the strong presumption was overcome, or sort of what's your legal anchor here?
I'm not totally sure I completely understand your question. I apologize. That's
yeah,
probably
well,
my fault.
I mean, to me, it sounds like there are kind of two things going on here. You're challenging the fact that the district court noted that no parties live here, you know, that there's a change in circumstances, and it seems... you're challenging the district court's reliance on that fact to then complete its analysis concerning the application of the presumption. At least it seems that way to me. So I'm trying to figure out what your legal argument is as to that circumstance.
So that change in circumstance, my legal argument is, should not be taken into cognizance.
Because it's not properly before the district court?
Correct.
Okay.
Because it was a later event. And the district court further erred, as you've alluded to, by holding that fact up and saying that in considering the private and public factors analysis, which it did simply by reincorporating Judge Piper's previously reversed and remanded decision, it said that fact, which the prior court had before it, is no longer part of it. But that doesn't cure the fact that there were two compound errors in doing that. First, the prior analysis by the trial court did not apply the correct presumption. Secondly, the prior analysis by the trial court relied on allegations, simply allegations in the complaint, as opposed to whether the defendants met their burden by coming forward to show that that under this equitable doctrine, that it would be more convenient for the courts, for the witnesses, and for the parties to be in California. The only people in California at this stage are the plaintiffs. There are no defendants in California. That was before the court on the first motion as well. So under those circumstances, I think it was a compound of an error based upon an error based upon an error. And so I do think the trial court abused its discretion. There is no proof in the record, to finish my answer to your question, Judge Conley, there is no proof in the record that the plaintiffs engaged in form shopping. And there needs to be some, the cases which have allowed for a lesser presumption, a weakened presumption, first, none of them are Minnesota State Court cases. Secondly, all those cases had already applied a weaker presumption to begin with. And third, all of those cases actually had citations to evidence in the record. All of those things are absent from this situation. Merely because plaintiff filed in a jurisdiction where all of the defendants were amenable to personal jurisdiction, and there were serious doubts as to whether that could be the case in California, that does not create forum shopping. I see my red light is up.
Thank you very much, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you for your courtesy.
You're welcome. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondents, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ambika Kumar on behalf of the respondents. This is the second time this case has come before this court, and it is the second time that appellants asked the court to condone what a trial court ultimately found was forum shopping. Unlike last time, however, the district court did not abuse its discretion here. The district court carefully followed this court's instructions on remand and found that this case does not belong in Minnesota. The court should affirm. Appellants have alleged three errors. Whether the district court adequately found that California is an adequate forum, whether it afforded the right deference to the plaintiff's choice of forum, and whether the conditions on the order were sufficient. And I'll address each in turn. To dismiss based on forum nonconvenience, the district court must find that the alternative jurisdiction is both available and adequate. There's no dispute that California is available. California is also adequate. A forum is adequate if a litigant has an effective legal remedy. In other words, if it permits litigation of the subject matter. Thus, courts have found that corruption in courts abroad, the inability to get equitable relief in a particular state, are not enough to make another forum inadequate. And indeed, a forum is only inadequate in very rare circumstances. Here, appellants claim that the district court erred by conducting no analysis of the statute of limitations differences, but the court had no need to do that because it ordered that respondents had waived their statute of limitations defenses that didn't exist in Minnesota in September of 2021. In other words, if this case is refiled in California, respondents will be unable to argue that the California statute of limitations applies at all. It will be the Minnesota statute of limitations. Appellants also claim that the condition is inadequate because it uses the date 2021 instead of 2019. Because under their theory, 28 U.S.C. 1367d told the statute of limitations for 30 days after the federal court dismissed their claims against respondents in California. But appellants are free to make that argument in California about the federal tolling statute. If the court were to condition it on, as they say, statute of limitations defenses available as of 2019, that would actually put them in a better position than they would be if they were in Minnesota. All that this court has to do and that Minnesota courts will do is to make sure that Minnesota procedural rights, including the statute of limitations, follows the case. The federal tolling statute...
So this is my question, is why it does seem that by potentially putting the date in there that the district court was making some kind of indication about that legal issue without deciding it, why wouldn't it have been more appropriate for the district court to use language more like what the court proposed in Kennecott, which is just they waive any procedural defenses that may have arisen since the action was commenced in Minnesota and leave it more broad as opposed to inserting the date?
I have to go back to Kennecott because I thought it was nearly identical to what was here, but you know, it may well not be. But here's what I will say. The district court was not required to decide whether federal law tolls the statute of limitations. That is not even if, Your Honor.
Does putting the date, I guess my question is, does putting the date into the order as opposed to just broadly saying no procedural defenses, by putting the date in, is it your position that limits what they can argue in California in any way? I guess that's the real question.
No, I think they're going to argue that the Minnesota statute of limitations applies. I think they're going to argue that it was told and that the relevant date is in 2017. And that's going to be a matter of an interpretation of 28 U.S.C. 1367.
It won't matter. The date that the district court selected in its order is not going to matter for the purpose of that argument from your position?
I don't think so because it says procedural defenses in Minnesota. Now, okay. You know, we're talking, again, the whole purpose of the condition is to render it adequate from the perspective of procedural law in Minnesota. So saying that in Minnesota this existed or didn't exist doesn't have any bearing on the federal law and the federal tolling statute. Briefly, I'll say that even if the court had implicitly decided the tolling issue, as stated in our papers, it didn't make an error. The claims that were in California were RICO claims and unfair competition law claims under California law and a defamation claim. And the 1367 only tolls the same claims. Now, the defamation claim does overlap. But what's interesting is that in California, respondents filed an anti-SLAPP statute. And what law did appellants use in responding to that on the defamation claim? California. California statute of limitations, California defamation law. There was no law, there was no hint at that point that Minnesota law would have anything to do with their lawsuit. And I think Judge Larson, you acknowledged also that even if there were tolling, our position is that the statute of limitations was run in both Minnesota and California. Turning to the presumption.
I have another question with regard to adequacy and the procedural requirements. Do you agree that California has determined that their anti-SLAPP statute is a procedural requirement as opposed to a substantive requirement?
I do not. We can jump ahead. That was going to be under conditions, but I'm happy to talk about it now.
I guess I see it as sort of going to the adequacy of the forum if what we're talking about is moving to a place that has a different anti-SLAPP regime than we have here in Minnesota, which is we currently don't have one.
Well, that's not actually accurate, Your Honor. You do have one as to equitable claims. The statute was struck down only as to the claims that have a jury trial right. In fact, when I was preparing for this, I found a case which I don't have in front of me from 2017, finding exactly that. It's a non-precedential opinion from this court saying that the SLAPP statute applied to the equitable claims at issue in the case because the portion of the statute that was overruled in Leyendecker was the portion that required a judge to make findings of fact that were reserved for a jury. But equitable claims don't carry a jury trial right, and so there is no constitutional problem with that portion of Minnesota statute. And in fact, we would argue that that portion of Minnesota statute applies to the claims for equitable relief. In terms of whether California is procedural or not, one thing I would say is no, I don't think so. Leyendecker called anti-SLAPP statutes in the nature of a substantive immunity. I think it's error to say it's procedural. Moreover, Minnesota, let me just say, is unique in its conditioning of procedural protections in going to another state.
So, because we think we're smarter than every other state.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that, so.
No, I did. Please continue.
So there's not a lot of law on this in other states, and the only law we have is Minnesota law, right? And Minnesota law doesn't say that every rule of procedure follows you to a different forum. The Minnesota rules of civil procedure don't follow somebody somewhere else. It's only where there's a conflict and only where there would be no remedy under the other state's law, and that is not the case here. The California anti-SLAPP statute is not a barrier. It's not a statute of limitations. It doesn't block the lawsuit. It requires the respondents, I mean the defendants, to come forth with some evidence in the beginning showing that they have a claim. And I would add that Minnesota and California have both expressed an interest in deterring lawsuits that chill free speech. That portions of the Minnesota anti-SLAPP statute were ruled unconstitutional doesn't mean that the policy of the state has changed. So there's no conflict between these two. California's, I mean, say what they may about California's law, but it's clear in California that the judge doesn't weigh evidence when it's making a decision on an anti-SLAPP statute, and that that was the exact constitutional infirmity that made the Minnesota Supreme Court find that its statute was unconstitutional.
But then how are we supposed to handle cases like Patel that say the anti-SLAPP statute is a procedural law rather than a substantive immunity?
Well, I acknowledge those cases exist. Those cases are, however, not deciding in the context of, my recollection is, substantive versus procedural law that made a difference as to application of the law as to whether they were procedural or not. But I will also say...
Well, but it does matter. I mean, you said there's not a lot of case law outside of Minnesota, but we're in Minnesota applying Minnesota law, where we grant procedural protections to people in this,
right,
in this context, and we have California telling us that this is a procedural statute, that they're interpreting their own law to be a procedural statute. Why doesn't that then require, under Minnesota law, the appellants to be entitled to those procedural protections when this case goes to California, or if this case goes to California?
The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the SLAPP statute is in the nature of a substantive immunity. I would say that matters
Minnesota's
more.
Minnesota's anti-SLAPP statute.
Well, they're both...
I mean, it was interpreting Minnesota's anti-SLAPP statute, not California's.
Sure, but the purpose
statute
of an anti-SLAPP statute is to make a defendant come forward. There are differences in the way that it's implemented, but the policy of the statute is the same. The other thing I would say is there is no Minnesota case that holds that anti-SLAPP statute protections or the absence of an anti-SLAPP protection follows a case wherever it goes. And in fact, federal courts have found in the Ninth Circuit that the anti-SLAPP statute provides a substantive immunity such that when a court is sitting in diversity jurisdiction, it applies the anti-SLAPP statute because it is not procedural. It's exact. Now, there are aspects of the SLAPP statute that might be
California's
procedural. The federal
That's my question. Are you saying that the federal courts have said California's anti-SLAPP statute is substantive, not procedural?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think that you would agree different states have different anti-SLAPP statutes that have different requirements.
Sure.
And so you could see a difference between Washington's anti-SLAPP statute, where I think they explicitly say that it's substantive. I think it's Washington's, where they say that it's substantive, and California's, where that they're saying it's procedural. And so you're saying that the federal courts have said California's. That's why I'm asking.
I'm happy to provide you lots of authority, but I can tell you, litigating in the Ninth Circuit, that courts routinely apply the California anti-SLAPP statute. Now, there is a caveat that the California anti-SLAPP statute has an automatic discovery stay, and federal courts don't apply that because they do view it as procedural. So there may be aspects of the procedure that shouldn't carry over, perhaps, but the SLAPP statute is applied under the Erie Doctrine. The California anti-SLAPP statute is applied under the Erie Doctrine routinely, and that's in the original set of briefing that I think is part of this court's record. And I guess the other thing I would even, well, no, I said it.
Have you gotten to the conditions yet?
Well, that is one of the conditions.
No.
So.
I do think I stopped you from getting to the presumption.
You did, but, you know, if your questions are about the conditions, you know, I'm happy to answer them.
So the appellants suggest that the violation of our remand mandate is heavily weighted on the anti-SLAPP statutes. Okay, the district court should have addressed that in addition to discussing, or in addition to allow you the waiver on statute of limitations jurisdiction process. And at oral argument below, your side suggested a possible remedy. Why shouldn't that remedy have been imposed as a condition, one of the conditions dealing with the anti-SLAPP statutes?
Well, respectfully, that was not briefed. It was at oral argument. I do remember it. I'm not sure I was correct when I suggested that remedy, and I will say the district court...
Well, it sounds... whoever suggested
it. Yeah, that's fine.
Like,
yeah.
why was it wrong not to impose a remedy specifically dealing with that?
Because the district court did what this court asked, which was to address the California anti-SLAPP statute. It found that the California anti-SLAPP statute does not suffer the same constitutional infirmities that the Minnesota SLAPP statute does, and thus found it unnecessary to impose a condition. And that was, again, an exercise of its discretion to which this court owes deference. The district court did not abuse its discretion. If this court were to find otherwise, it would be suggesting that, you know, we're always going to line at it what the district court did to find every slight possibly mistaken conclusion, when the reality is the district court made factual findings. It decided that the private and public factors overcome the plaintiff's choice of forum, deference. And on that presumption...
But this is my confusion, is I think the district court found that the anti-SLAPP statute is procedural as opposed to substantive.
I understand that. I think that's a question of law this court can revisit. But even if it is procedural, Your Honor, there is no case in the state of Minnesota that says every procedural protection, every single...
Give me an example of a case where we said a procedural protection that existed in Minnesota did not apply?
No, this doesn't come up very much. It comes up mostly in the statute of limitations situation. And the reason for that is sound. The statute of limitations is a bar to a claim. The SLAPP statute is not a bar to a claim. And there is no conflict between, and I would, as we've argued below and in the briefing, we think a choice of law analysis should be done and that the California anti-SLAPP statute would apply, even in Minnesota. So we do think it's substantive. I understand your concern with the district court saying it is procedural. But to hold that a litigant who comes to Minnesota and shops for a forum in Minnesota can simply file here and then carry protections from laws designed to deter lawsuits just like this would be inequitable and not in line with even Minnesota's state policy favoring the dismissal of lawsuits that target free speech.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Counsel. Mr. Deutsch, you'll have the last word, sir.
Sure, as soon as I figure out how to move
Sorry.
The...
it's in the middle.
Yeah, it's camp.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Take your time.
There's a...
Here. Time.
Oh, perfect.
If you're short, you can find it.
It's a little counterintuitive.
It would be awkward to crouch down and try to do this.
Well, as I've said many times, we spent $200,000 for that, so...
So let's...
God, you're using it.
So I'm delighted to have the opportunity. What didn't you hear from the respondents? You didn't hear how... For these non-California residents, how California has suddenly become a more convenient forum for them. They're not in California. They wish to go to California because they wish to avail themselves of a California anti-SLAPP procedure. You don't have to guess. The district court did get that correct based on Patel. And if you look at our briefing, we cited cases from all six appellate districts in California, every one of them describes the California anti-SLAPP law as procedural. Judge Larson, your questions with respect to conditioning the dismissal, I think it's clear that in Berquist, where they condition the dismissal, and it's important language, and I'm going to read it, that there is no other procedural impediment to full litigation under the substantive law of Sweden. So all the procedural aspects had to be essentially resolved in the favor of the plaintiff in that situation. Similar to that here, where the Kennicott case says procedural rights of the plaintiff shall not yield to convenience on a transfer. Under those circumstances, I think it is the correct decision. If this court is going to determine that it should be dismissed, then the conditions have to be both correct on terms of the statute of limitations and the date so that there is no argument as to waiver. And I think it has to be correct in terms of the anti-SLAPP protections. The district court...
Well, then why on the first one, perhaps... it's my understanding from respondents' argument that who cares about the date? it's going to be a loser. Or, excuse me, well, you can make the arguments you can make, no matter whether it's September, July, or 2001, 20. I mean, why is that wrong? That seemed to make, again, speaking only for myself, a lot of sense to me.
Well, then why should they care if we choose an earlier date for this? If it makes no practical difference to them and to their arguments, why are they fighting so hard for it? It's their burden to demonstrate that this is an appropriate action to take to transfer this case. They've failed to do that. And they have merely said that it is barred under both jurisdictions, but I don't think that's correct. And you don't know whether that's correct because the district court didn't undertake the analysis to determine whether it was an adequate forum. That was an error. That was an abuse of discretion, especially given the instructions of this court.
Which we review under an abuse of discretion standard.
Correct, where it's clearly erroneous by law.
You know, the exact instruction, and God forgive me, I thought it was clear. We note that if on remand the district court determines that Minnesota is an inconvenient forum dismiss case, it must do so in the condition that California is available alternative forum after addressing statute of limitations and the anti-SLAPP laws. The court did discuss the anti-SLAPP laws, and I'm at a loss to understand why that analysis was not enough, or that analysis abused the district court's discretion and indicates that remand instruction was not followed.
For several reasons. First, the Christian v. Birch case says that once you determine it is a procedural remedy, then you stop. Then you're done. You don't continue. Secondly, the district court then erred in terms of its, on the law, in terms of its analysis of the California anti-SLAPP statute, and it ignored the law that states that essentially that the California state courts do view this as akin to a summary judgment proceeding. The district court was not empowered to say it is somehow less procedural-ish than the Minnesota statute that was overturned by Lean Decker. The district court erred in attempting to determine whether the Minnesota Supreme Court would have found this statute constitutional. The district.
Does that matter if California has said that that's a procedural rule? Does it matter whether what the Minnesota Supreme Court would say about California's anti-SLAPP statute?
It matters if that is the basis upon which the Minnesota District Court determines to not grant the same procedural rights that the plaintiffs would have had in Minnesota when the case is transferred purely for the convenience of the parties and the witnesses and the court. And under those circumstances, we are supposed to. The trial court ended its order by saying, the position of the parties shall be as if they remain in Minnesota, but that is not the case then if California anti-SLAPP law applies. California anti-SLAPP law is procedural, and Minnesota would not apply that. And under those circumstances, I think the trial court ignored the remand instructions and abused its discretion in making its determination, and ignored the Supreme Court's determinations in both Kennicott and Berquist. And I think there are multiple errors, all of which independently and collectively constitute an abuse of discretion. And I see my light is blinking. So if I'm happy to answer further questions or.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Deutsch. Thank you, Ms. Kumar. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thank you, Ms. Marks. It was a privilege to see you again. Since I'm retiring in 4 years, with any luck at all, I won't see you again. Well, that being our last case, we are adjourned.
All thank rise. You.